That music was All Good Medicine by Galana from the album Feather on the Wind. And we listened to that music because today on the show we're going to be talking about All Good Medicine with Dr. Roger Truby. This is BBS Radio, the voice of the people. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Sherry Edwards, your host on this next hour of Sound Health. And on this show, we attempt to bring you ideas and information in support of self-health, the concept that you're responsible for your health from the inside out. As most of you know, on this show, we're sponsored by the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology, and we had an exciting day here today. We had two clients, one dealing with peripheral neuropathy, asking us if we could do something about that. It was a doctor referral. And we found out that he could not utilize B1 or B2 very effectively. And that was causing him not to be able to use something called etiocobalamin, which is a form of B12 for the muscles. So we were able to help him feel his feet and hands and the tip of his nose again. And it was kind of exciting when he was saying, oh, that really hurts. It's tingling. It's prickling. It's like pin prickles. And it was his feet and hands coming awake again. And I said, well, you want me to stop? And he said, no, I can feel my feet. I love it. And it's exciting to be able to help people realize that this can happen to their body again. Because what we do here is research on sound and its effect on living systems. And so we took his vocal print and we were able to correlate that to other homogeneous groups of peripheral neuropathy who had peripheral neuropathy and help them. One of the things we found is that the measles virus, when you get older, particularly if you're male, that measles virus begins to turn on you and begins to erode the nerve fibers. And so a lot more peripheral neuropathy is coming into the population now. The other lady that we were able to help came here for macular degeneration, which means she lost a piece of her vision, a very large piece, almost as big as her fist. When we looked at a piece of paper that was 8.5 by 11 and put a grid on it, she drew the outline of where she couldn't see, and it was as big as your palm or fist. And, you know, 2 days later, as we're working on her, those areas she can't see are about the size of a couple of dimes put together. And that's awesome to be able to help people bring back their sight and see how that opens their world. I'm not a doctor. I love helping and being in support of people. But our guest today, Dr. Roger Truby, is a doctor. He's a doctor of naturopathic medicine. Did I say that right? And also, you have a PhD in public health and preventive care. So he's taken time out of his busy day to talk to us about the new medicine and how he is a part of that. Dr. Truby, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here with you.
You probably had a busy day, but we need to know about what you do because we think that people like you are going to lead us into a new form of non-traditional medicine that we're really seeking. We want out of this allopathic, very selfish, very money-driven medicine. So can you talk to us about the difference in your practice? Where is your practice?
My office is in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Actually, Hot Springs National Park, Arkansas, the smallest of all the national parks.
And you have a non-traditional practice.
I do, and we differ a lot from allopathic medicine, and been some big differences in individuals for some time now. Probably the last, 7 or 8 years, is the number of visits to alternative practitioners are actually exceeding the number of visits to traditional practitioners, your physicians and so forth. And people are looking, they're wanting something different. So much of the time I hear patients complain that when they go to their physician, they get 3 to 5 minutes and a prescription. And they really want to know more about what's going on, what's the problems, why do I get this, why do I get these chronic ear infections, or why did my daughter get these chronic ear infections, or these chronic urinary tract infections. And so we try to find the underlying factors behind what's going on. I want to know if there's any nutrient depletions. I want to know if there's any hidden allergens, or if the person has been overloaded with some heavy metal toxicity, such as, you know, mercury or lead, arsenic. I found a patient, I've had a couple patients with 8 to 9 times the upper limit of lead in their bodies, upper limit of safety, I should say. So I want to know about chronic infections and if there's any biochemical weaknesses that are setting this individual up for having some problems. Once you know those underlying factors, it really doesn't make any difference what we call the disease or the symptoms. What really matters is trying to correct those underlying factors and allow the body to do its healing. And the body will do its healing, and it will do a very nice job if we give it the opportunity by taking away from it the things that are hurting it and adding to it the things that it needs.
So you're treating the whole person.
And the whole person is right. In some cases, you have to find the psychological or the spiritual factors for individuals. I've said many individuals, you're not going to get well until you forgive the individual who you're angry with that has caused you to be hurting. And so many times, without looking at some of these underlying factors associated with the underlying psychological or spiritual factors, this individual will just not get well. So it's very important to be able to understand what's going on in that particular area of the individual. And unfortunately, it's not comfortable for the patient many times, but you have to get into that and say, look, you have to deal with this. It's very, very important to bring this out and to deal with it, for the fact that the psychological and the spiritual factors will oftentimes block any physical healing that should take place.
One of the things I was very impressed when I first met you is that you're a very gentle, caring person. You really want to make a difference. And it reminded me of the old-fashioned doctor that we had in our small community when I was a child, and I'm in my 60s, so it was a long time ago. How do you feel about what's happening now to doctors, that they don't have that same feel?
No, in many cases, they're pressured for time, and I don't blame the physicians entirely. They get a medical school, they're $200,000 in debt in some cases, at least $100,000, and they're pushed to make that up, and there's only a few ways of doing it, and that's to make a lot of money, to see a lot of patients, and there's only one way to do that, and you press it. And so when they get out, in many cases, they join a practice. They don't set up their solo practice like they used to. They join a practice, and that practice, run by another organization, says you have to see 35 patients minimum a day. We really want you to see 45 or 50 before very long. And if you don't, we just can't keep you here. So there, in many cases, they're pressured to do this. And so you can't be very empathetic with individuals. You can't convey that deep need to heal and that you feel for them and you want them, and you push it through. And so, and eventually after a while, it just gets the way that you do things. And so it's kind of sad, but we have lost that beautiful, caring attitude that you talked about that's so important, so necessary to convey to patients.
Well, they don't have time to see everything. Your right eyelash hurts, and so that's the only thing they can treat.
In some cases, of course, you come in when you can come in with one item. If you have two items, you come back for a second visit. Now, that disturbs patients. They want to take care of several things, and I can't tell you the number of people who come to me to talk about, 10 different things. We can't address all of them always, but we certainly can deal with some of those, and we try to cover the whole thing that they have troubles with, but you know, with many cases, you have to deal with one thing at a time.
Where's this pressure to hurry coming from?
Well, I do think that, you know, managed care is where the big factor is at. Managed care, you know, is basically designed to put people in a system that forces a physician to be a part of that organization. I can tell you a physician that was here in Hot Springs that was, he was doing chelation therapy. It's an alternative procedure, and he felt like it was really benefiting and helping patients. Once managed care moved in, you know, he's forced to kind of join another practice, because he can't be there 100% of the time, but no one will see his patients if he's not part of a group practice. And no one will take care of him, no one will take call for him. So they said, well, you can come on into our practice, but leave the chelation therapy at the door when you come.
And that helps so many people.
Yeah, it's sad, but that's what happens. And so, you know, patients get the raw end of the deal, as it were. But managed care will force physicians to see X number of patients a month. And then, of course, in addition to that, I've got good friends here, they're physicians. They were spent their first probably 12 years of their life as their medical life as missionaries in Africa. And they truly have a caring attitude towards patients. But, you know, now the one physician, she is retired, but she just, the last few years, she just did not care for medicine at all, because so much paperwork and so much red tape of doing this and making sure you do that. And says it just lost the appeal and the joy of healing patients for her.
I think one of the disgusting things I recently found out is if I go to my doctor and he charges me $70 for a half-hour visit, he gets less than half of that. The insurance company takes the majority of it.
Yeah.
That, to me, is unfair. They didn't do the work.
Yeah.
They simply administered what was going on.
Yeah.
And it makes me want to drop my insurance.
Yeah, it's a sad situation when that happens like that, for sure. I hear you.
This is my perception, so correct me if I'm wrong, that allopathic medicine is symptom and disease control, but preventive medicine is really where you want to look at if you're going to deal with the whole person.
Yeah, you know, I think that if you look at it another way, that traditional medicine tends to be condition specific. You come in, tell me your problem, and then we simply categorize it in terms of a disease. So here's a set of symptoms. Oh, that is this disease. So it's condition specific, and then we have got a drug for that particular disease, and so that's very condition specific. Whereas I think what most naturopathic practitioners, and of course many involved, as you are in your practice as well, are more person-specific in alternative approaches. That person-specific, you know, says that we want to know about the biochemical individuality of the individual. What is different about him or her that's making them come into this office? What kind of problems are they having that we need to find out specifically about them? So that's the big factor. I mean, you know, if a person comes in with fatigue, you know, we don't really have a lot of things that in the drug area for fatigue. Well, there happens to be a lot of things that can cause fatigue, as you know, anemia, adrenal weakness, thyroid, chronic infections, allergy, a B vitamin deficiency, mineral deficiency. So in a condition-specific therapeutic mode that many physicians are in, that you can't solve that problem because there's too many possibilities in that area, and most physicians, unfortunately, don't go tracking those things down. But that's what I think individuals in an alternative area or complementary medicine like to do, is to track down what are the factors that are causing that person to be fatigued. The last patient, you know, was anemic, but this person may not be anemic. they may be a thyroid problem. They maybe have stressed their adrenals out and need to be addressed. So it's a very person-specific approach, I think.
I think one of the things going on is people don't want to pay if there's nothing wrong. You know, if I just go to the doctor at once every 6 weeks to see if there's anything wrong, they don't really want to pay for that unless they're in pain or something. And the people that we get here, I want us to be thought of first. And that's coming. But most of our referrals are from doctors who have exhausted what they can do for their client. And so we take those people and work on them. But I think, and, you know, my rose-colored wish for the world is every time you go into a doctor's office, just as they take your temperature and your blood pressure, they're going to take your vocal print. You want to send it to some central place, and it's going to spit it back and say, hey, you might want to consider this. So getting people used to that prevention that this may happen down the road, I think that's a different thought form. You have any ideas?
Well, that's it, and I think one of the problems, of course, that you have that mitigates against that is the fact that people depend so much on insurance today, and insurance will not pay for something that may come about, not what is not already in place. So while you might be able to say to a person, as you have in the past, look, you're headed for a thyroid storm. In fact, that's not what they're going to pay for. They're going to only pay for something that you have wrong with you now. And people have become so dependent, unfortunately, on the financial factors associated with insurance that, like you say, you don't get people coming in very often that says, I think I'm okay. Can you tell me if I am? And I don't have that either. People come in with problems that they have, but it's not so much tell me if everything else can look at it and see if there's anything else that you think I might need to do differently before anything happens. I just don't get those individuals. I'd like to, but they don't come around.
I think it's going to happen, though. Preventive medicine is going to be where it is if we have our way about it. And I'm talking about you and me both, because I consider you a leader in the education of people about non-traditional medicine and preventive, and you actually helped start a school to train wellness providers in this and kind of got stopped. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes, I didn't really help start it. I actually went there as a student. That was in the second year of the school, and I guess maybe helped to maintain it one thing after I graduated from the university. That was the Capital University of Integrative Medicine in Washington, D.C. I was asked to stay on and chair the department that is really looking at the natural sciences. And so yes, I was involved with the university for several years until it had to fold, unfortunately. But it was a wonderful university because of the fact that it's so many people that are really thirsting and as potential practitioners who want to bring a difference to their practice. And we had physicians and dentists and chiropractors and nurses and physical therapists and many different individuals who wanted to bring natural healing methods to the masses, because there's people out there thirsting for it there, and people want that. They want to have alternative means of being able to heal and to live better. And so certainly it was time for it to be here. It was sad to see it go.
Well, the statistics prove out that people are seeking more alternative methods, which to me, the other side of that is they're losing faith in allopathic medicine.
Yeah, you know, I think has been described before, you know, allopathic medicine gets an A for acute care. There's no better place to be if you're in a tragic automobile accident. On the other hand, if you've got a chronic degenerative disease like multiple sclerosis, we're getting a D-. That's where our grade is in allopathic medicine. And part of the problem is that physicians tend to apply acute care methods to chronic diseases, and it does not work. In an acute care, you want to immediately give the person some type of medicine or drug or so forth that will save a life, that will keep the person breathing, get their blood pressure up if they're falling and so forth, and or give them some medicine to help them breathe if they're having an asthma attack. You can't do that in chronic care, so you got to take the underlying factors behind asthma and say, okay, what's causing this problem, and let's find out what's happening with it. So, sad, but we use the wrong methods for the acute care methods to apply for both areas, and we can't do that without causing some problems.
And I want to tell a story on myself, because I think we the people can take more responsibility. One Friday evening, I got something caught in my throat, and it was jabbing me and sticking me like something very sharp. And I didn't want to call my doctor on Friday. I'll wait till Monday morning, and I don't want to go to the emergency room for something so stupid. So I wait till Monday morning, and he sends me to the emergency room. So I've got this thing caught in my throat, or I think I do, and they put a little mirror up there, and they prod, and they poke, and they find nothing, and so they decided to do something where they put me in this big round barrel thing, and they said, no, there's absolutely nothing there. We think this is all in your head, and I'm still being stuck with this thing, and in the meantime, they've stuck a needle in my hand and made a big golf ball-size blood blister. And I've been there for hours, okay, it's in my head, that's what you guys feel, I'm going home. I went home and took my husband's water pick, stuck it up in where it hurt, exactly where it hurt, washed everything out, and out came a nutshell, actually two of them, one with a very sharp edge, and instantly, no pain. Now, that probably cost my insurance company $2,500. If I'd had any sense, why didn't I use the water pick before I went? I wanted to put my faith in the doctor that I got something caught up here, and I want you to take care of it. And that was such a good lesson for me, to try to deal with it on my own. And I don't want to admit that I was that dumb that I didn't think of that.
Well, you know, I think for many individuals, now you are the exception out there, but for many individuals, there's a fear out there that, well, maybe something is worse. Maybe I need to, who knows? I mean, you just never know. And so for so many individuals, it's that fear of the unknown that drives them to their physician, that they want someone to tell them everything is okay, or nope, you've got this particular problem here, and then they'll feel better. If they can't get that satisfaction, then they'll come to some individuals like you or I, and because they're just not getting satisfactory response. But it's that unknown fear that will drive people to their physicians first. And rather than saying, okay, let's try something first on our own and go that way, that we take the idea that maybe it's the worst case scenario as opposed to the not-so-worst-case scenario and try some natural things first.
How is it, though, that you can go to a hospital, and I don't know what they did, a CAT scan or something, and their conclusion was this was all in my head. Now, I've got this record at the hospital that I imagine that I've got something stuck in my throat.
Yeah.
They just don't look any further. They can't find it with their methods, and I'm not putting all the they people, in a bad pot, because we have a lot of wonderful doctors who work with us. But in that, you said acute care kind of thing, their machines couldn't do it, and just to rely back on something very simple, like, a water pick, because I knew it was in there, I knew it was sticking me.
Well, this goes back to, I find it so helpful at times, to take a good history, and this is oftentimes not done very well, is your symptoms. And I want to know when those symptoms started. What was happening when they started? And oftentimes you get a lot of clues then. And maybe if someone would have taken a good history and says, well, when did this start? What were you doing before this happened? Because obviously it's in the mouth. There could be something related to food. Would you have anything like this that you were eating prior to this thing coming on? So it's amazing the number of things that actually come out that I tell a person, they tell me that this thing was going on for 2 years, And then I, for instance, will ask them, well, I noticed you're on this particular drug. How long have you been on this drug? And they said, well, for the same, you know, for 2 years as well. And I said, well, do you see a connection there, perhaps? And so a history is so valuable, and perhaps that might have pulled things out if they'd have done that for you.
Yes. Sometimes, though, I think people get secondary gain from being sick. I know I grew up with soap operas, and people were actually their disease, and their whole life ran around their disease. Secondary gain, and also, do you think people are getting more ill than they used to? Because they're saying, okay, gout's increasing, heart disease is increasing, we have AIDS, we have MRSA, we have, you know, are we just generally less healthy?
Without question, I think that's the case. There's a couple different factors that are encouraging that to be the case, and that is, one, the nutrient quality of food is deteriorating, you know, unfortunately, to a very large extent. And then people are eating worse than they ever were had before. Not only are we getting less nutrients in the foods that we are told to eat, the good foods, but those foods have less nutrients, but we're also choosing poor quality foods. So that's one huge area that we just cannot ignore. And the second factor, of course, is that when you look at the amount of chemical toxicity that people are holding on to, it is astounding that any of us are not actually sick all the time. The Environmental Working Group did a study on the cord blood of newborns, and what they found, they were looking at, I believe, in the range of about 250 different chemicals that they were actually testing for. They found that at the moment of birth, babies were holding on to, I think, about 200 chemicals. That was the average they were holding on to at the moment of birth.
They like food preservatives or something?
Oh, these could be any type of chemicals. It could be rocket fuel that came from the lettuce the mother had consumed, you know, with her diet. It could be chemicals that are found in the food supply, but also pesticides of various kinds. It could be heavy metals. It could be certainly chemicals of that come from her cosmetics that she was putting on. The dozens of chemicals that are found in cosmetics. Most people don't realize that what you put on your skin, you're consuming. I tell patients, whatever you put on your skin, you're eating, because it will be absorbed to one degree or another. So, you know, by all means, think carefully about what's going on in your skin. We put on, deodorant or actually antiperspirant. We're not realizing we're putting on, in many cases, parabens, a cancer-causing chemical, and aluminum. And these kinds of things are just, without thinking about it, these things go on our bodies, in our bodies, and then they're make up part of our bodies, and mothers will download these chemicals and toxins to their fetuses.
I want to ask you about two things, about food supply and also, do you have an ideal diet people should be eating?
Well, it's a real tough one, but I tell you, if you can just summarize a few things, and you can't summarize it completely, but, I give patients what I call an anti-inflammatory diet sheet, and it really tells about the kind of things that we're eating that are causing inflammation in the body. But in essence, I tell people, for the majority of individuals, get lots of vegetables and adequate protein and reduce the amount of carbs you're taking in. People just we're taking in too many carbs. You know, back in the 70s, individuals, we were all told, you know, low-fat diet, that was the big thing. I mean, I was going through school. I mean, everybody was touting this low-fat diet, regardless of whether it was, it was selling all kinds of products. So the result of that was that we had an explosion of diabetes, an explosion of obesity, and it's taken a medical toll on the country to an extent that has never been seen before. with the kind of diseases that are resulting from this. So, you know, reducing the amount of food that people are consuming, getting adequate protein foods, and reducing our carbohydrate foods. So it's tough to say in an oral form here. Here's an adequate diet for you. But in the summary, that's kind of what I push people towards.
And by carbohydrate diet, cookies, cakes, pancake, bread, crackers.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And all snack foods and our corns. And so, in essence, you get away from a lot of the white stuff, white flour products. And, you know, when you have a grain, make it a whole wheat. But in many cases, you'll find that wheat is a real potential allergen for a lot of people. And so the numbers of individuals who are sensitive to wheat and gluten are becoming increasingly a problem. And they used to say 1 in 30,000. They said 1 in 3,000, and now it's closer to 1 in 150 are having a problem with gluten foods. Gluten being the ingredient in grains or bread that causes it to rise. So yes, you can say eating a whole grain, but in essence, I tend to encourage people to move away from more grains. If you look at what people ate, you know, a few thousands of years ago, their great-great-great-great-great-grandfather would get out of his hut and in the morning, and there was not a bakery store down the street. There wasn't a loaf of bread on the shelf, and certainly didn't have a refrigerator. And he went out and he started, with his bow and arrow or a spear or something, would maybe shoot a rabbit or catch a fish. Maybe grab some herbs or some berries on the way back, and he had his stew and his berries for his dessert, and that was basically what he ate. So we didn't have all the goodies, and so we certainly like to enjoy those things, but when we do, we pay a price for that. So I really encourage people to look at what we ate years ago and say it's what people call a Paleolithic diet, as it were. And tend to encourage people to move towards that kind of a diet.
One of the things that we're finding is with people who are allergic to wheat, that thymopoietin is just not working right in their body. And we back them, we will look at that, and it's thiamine. And then you go look at how they process wheat, and they take the thiamine out, and they feed it to us anyway. So it's not complete enough for our body to use it.
Yes, this is unfortunate the case. You know, it's like they said before, you know, it's like taking out about $15 out of a person's pocket and giving them back $4 and saying that now you're enriched. It's a sad commentary because we're not enriched at all. We're eating very processed foods, and the kind of the type of vitamin that's added back is synthetic. Most vitamins today that we get are a synthetic type produced from coal tar. It's a petroleum product. And so the utilization of that in the body is very, very poor. We need to be using vitamins coming from whole foods. So the body knows how to use those, but we don't get very many of those in, unfortunately.
Well, one of the things I'm noticing also, maybe 10 years ago, a lot of the food in the grocery store was all packaged in a box. You needed instant, you know, oatmeal. You could make hamburger skillet in 15 minutes for your family. But now there's a lot more fresh fruits and vegetables coming back in. So we the people can make a difference by just not buying that junk.
Exactly, and that's the push. I mean, you know, you find people want that kind of stuff. They ask for it, and I think the other thing is you're seeing a lot more in the grocery stores is more organic.
Yes.
You do have to be suspicious. A lot of places, you know, I'm very suspicious of some of the Walmart organic things, like some of the organic milk and so forth. The quality of the dairies they get it from, it's more expensive to produce organic, without question, and it's not cost effective. So being able to actually buy it at the same price you would normally buy other things for, you will not be able to expect to do that. But so much more valuable. But you're right, the amount of of fresh foods that are available. And the number of farmers markets, you know, has really gone up too. And those are always great to see more farmers markets where you can get some fresh stuff as well.
Mm-hmm. So you think food is a clue? And how about side effects from all the medications, not just the toxins? Things like cholesterol medication. You know, I looked at some of their ingredients, and some of it is just glorified niacin. Why are they adding all of this other stuff here?
You know, I couldn't tell you the number of cases of patients who come with a particular set of symptoms, and we look at the drugs that they're taking, and we find that the symptoms are the very side effects of the drugs that they're on, and I tell them, look, there's not a lot I can do about this. I can't give you some herb or some vitamin or some amino acid or some homeopathic or something. I can't change your lifestyle, you know, to change this with, because if you're on this drug, now eventually if you can get off this drug, you're going to see some improvement in your symptoms. But these, I mean, but it's so common to see this. I mean, you would be amazed when you actually look at these the set of symptoms that people have and the drugs they're using, how exactly they correlate.
Aren't there herbs and natural substances that can be used in place of those drugs?
In many, many cases there is. And of course, one of the kind of patient I see so often is the one who says, I'm on these drugs. I don't want to be on them. Help me to get off of these drugs. That was in part the one today. He was on Ambien, and he just can't get away from it. Well, it's an addicting type drug, and but he can't sleep if he doesn't. So we're using some amino acids, and in his case, and we're going to be using those amino acids, and those amino acids are precursors to the neurotransmitters, which is what Ambien is working on. So eventually, as he's on those things long enough, we anticipate being able to downturn the amount of Ambien that he's using, and then eventually drop it off entirely. There are some great things that can be done. Not in every case, though. I like to look at it as an alternative. Is to say, okay, try the alternatives first. If they're successful, great. Unless you're in an acute situation, try alternatives first. If that doesn't work, then go to the drugs, but in many cases they probably will work. And if they don't work, it's probably because you haven't given enough time to find some of those underlying conditions. And if there's a blood pressure problem, maybe the blood pressure, the herbs are not working because you're loaded up with lead, which is affecting the kidneys, causing the blood pressure problem in the first place. So, you know, those are the kind of things that should be tried first, I think. And the drugs should be the last resort.
I want to talk a little bit about how you deal with helping people with toxic metals. But we had a lady in, and she was on some blood thinner. I think it was Gentovin, something like that. And the doctor had warned her not to take ginkgo with that because it would make her blood too thin. Now, if the doctor knew that ginkgo biloba was going to thinner blood anyway, why can't that be the first choice?
Yeah.
What's the mindset that we have to go with a med first and not try an herb or homeopathic?
Well, physicians, you know, for one thing, aren't trained in this area, so they certainly have no desire. It is, to them, it's so much easier. When I take a person that has a problem like this, you know, I'm going to be talking to them for, you know, half an hour about some of these things, and I'll be explaining the role of a healthy form of vitamin E that's got the mixed tocopherols, not just your D-alpha, but you want your D-gamma tocopherol. And we'll talk about things like natokinase, which effectively allows the blood to flow freer in the body. And we'll talk about some of the role of this of fish oil, which is so important in allowing the blood to freely move through the vascular system. So these things, which always would be working along with, say, things like ginkgo biloba, you know, are not used at all because it takes too long. It's again, we get back to this time factor, and the for one thing, it's time. It takes longer to explain it. And two, it's called standard of care. And physicians are under an obligation to give standard of care treatment. So the problem comes with a individual who comes in with a blood disorder problem, and their blood needs to be thinned at least temporarily. If they were to give them ginkgo biloba and it didn't work, as it's the case with other blood thinners, doesn't work, I'm talking about prescription kind, if the person had died, then the family could easily sue that physician, and you couldn't find a physician out of 100 that would stand behind that physician who said he did a good job in prescribing ginkgo biloba. So the standard of care problem that physicians are under requires them to prescribe something that is considered standard of care. If it's not standard of care, their license can be pulled. So it's not just the physician. It's the obligation that he is under as a member of the medical society. He couldn't have his license pulled. He couldn't get hospital privileges. I mean, there's so many things that mitigate against that make a person make a physician more difficult for them to actually prescribe, things like natural medicines.
So if people wanted to come to you, though, could you help them get off their meds?
Well, if they were around here, but certainly I would tell them to, I always tell them to find a practitioner that's really close to where they're at. If they're in your area, without question, I'd be sending them to see you. If I knew somebody else in a different area, if I don't know where someone is in their area, because in many cases they need to be followed through carefully and looked at carefully. So I say, go to someone in your area that you're in so that you can follow through on this. It's not just a one-shot deal, because it doesn't work that way. And if they don't know, I often will tell them, well, look, talk to the local health food stores that are in the area and ask them if they know a practitioner who's really into, alternative care and treatment. And they will usually give pretty good advice. They'll usually know of a physician, even sometimes an MD or a DO, or sometimes a chiropractor, sometimes a naturopathic doctor that may be practicing alternative care in their area, and refer them to that area.
So you don't do any phone consultations or things like that with people that have to come to you?
I've done some. Yes, I've done some phone consultations. Sometimes it's a little more difficult because I like to know what's going on. So as we mentioned, for instance, a person who has high blood pressure, wants to get off or wants to maybe lower their medication, they may need to lose weight. I'd like to find out about their heavy metal load, which may be part of their problem. So, I can't do that over the phone is the problem. That's the limitation that you get.
How would somebody know they had a high heavy metal load?
In many cases, they wouldn't. Occasionally, you'll find a taste in the mouth that's a metallic taste. But for the most part, most people would not know and do not know that they're holding onto these things. But I do that. We have people, take a chelator of some type. We use DMSA and have them take some DMSA capsules. DMSA is a binder of heavy metals. It has a stronger affinity to the metal than the tissues do, and so it's like a magnet, just pulls that metal that's around it, the heavy metal that's around in the tissues, and then it pulls it out of the tissues and deposits in the urine. So we have them collect urine for 6 hours after taking the capsules, and then send it off to a laboratory where they evaluate for the presence of heavy metals. That's how we find out.
So you do urine tests? Do you do hair tests of someone?
You can do a hair test is also another clue. One of the problems, of course, with hair analysis in looking at heavy metals is that it's a highly dependent upon the levels of cysteine in the hair. If a person doesn't have a lot of cysteine, then the hair is not going to bind it. But hair is a good means the body has of getting rid of hair, getting rid of toxic metals. Of course, that's how we found out that some famous people in history were being poisoned. They would check the hair and find a level of arsenic in the hair. But as is always the case, if we find it in the hair, it's solid evidence that they've got a heavy metal. If it's not in the hair, I can't always trust it to be sure because they may not be binding. You know, one of the things that autistic children cannot bind heavy metals and clear it out. And so you take a look at compare autistic children, the heavy metals in the hair versus non-autistic kids. And the autistic kids have lower heavy metal in the hair than the non-autistic kids do. And what it says is the exact opposite of what one would think. The non-autistic kids are getting rid of their heavy metals, where these autistic kids are unable to do so, and they keep being stored in more and more and higher amounts in the brain until it has some deleterious effects.
So you put them on something that'll help clear that?
Yes, there are several things that can be available. NDF is a substance that's out there. They're metal free is another name. These can be looked up on the internet through search engines. I use a product called HM Nano Detox. HM standing for heavy metal. It's less expensive, but in a nanoparticle form, it's able to get past the blood-brain barrier, and I believe at least pull heavy metals out of the brain and also tissues of the body as well, because it penetrates the cell very easily. And so the use of heavy metal nano detox from Premier Research Labs is, I think, an excellent remedy to be able to pull these heavy metals out of the body. Sometimes it takes weeks, sometimes months, and in some cases years. Chelation therapy is another means. Many physicians will do that through the intravenous means of chelation, but some do it orally as well. But there's a number of means out there to remove heavy metal out of the body.
You mentioned, you sent us some articles. Do you have a website where people can look at some of the articles and things you've done?
I don't right now. I'm working on putting one in place. It's one thing that I put off for a number of years and should have, that just did not. In the process of developing a website right now, but it's not in place and may not be for a couple months, probably 2-3 months. It's still in the hands of the web developer, and he hasn't given it back to me ready to start adding things to it yet.
Are you available for things like lectures and workshops, conferences?
Yeah, I've done those kind of things. I have in the past, and I do those kind of things. Sure.
How would you prefer someone get in touch with you?
They can email me or call if they need to, but emailing me is fine, or calling me either way is okay. Depends on the situation. My email rjtruby, that's T-R-U-B-E-Y, 224, @gmail.com. And phone, my office number, 501-624-1248.
Okay, and I will put those on the description of the show also. You mentioned earlier that just sometimes you put people in a diet, like inflammation. What is an inflammation diet?
Well, that's a good question. There's a lot of things in our diet that are causing inflammation. Let me give you an example. Grain oils, soy, sunflower, safflower, corn, these kind of oils are high in omega-6 fatty acids. Their eventual outcome is to increase the amount of inflammation in our body because we're eating too much of them. You know, there's a certain amount of inflammation which is good. If you get a thorn in your skin, under your skin, that inflammation is what helps to fight infection. So a certain amount of inflammation is good. Like a certain amount of fire in a fireplace is warm and inviting, but certainly too much inflammation, too much fire, and coming out of the fireplace is not a good idea. Our bodies are loaded with inflammation right now. There's way too much inflammation, and part of it is the fact that we're eating way too many omega-6 fatty acids from those kinds of oils and far less omega-3 fatty acids, which are coming from our fish. particularly salmon and cod and those kinds of fish, omega-3 fatty acids. So an example of how this happens is you could take beef, for instance. The epitome of a great steak is corn-fed beef. Well, what have we done? We've taken a cow that should never be consuming corn and giving him corn oil from the corn. And so what's happened is that you take the compare, for instance, a corn-fed steak or a steak that you buy at a grocery store, the omega-6-3 ratio is about 16 to 1. When you compare that with a grass-fed beef, which is what the cow was designed to be eating in the first place, you have a 1-to-1 omega-6-3 ratio. Omega-3 is an anti-inflammatory oil, and so it helps to reduce the amount of inflammation going on in the body. And so I think it's one example of how we've actually created a bad food, beef, not because it's bad per se, but because of what we've done to the animal. Besides the hormones that we inject it with and the antibiotics that it's fed, which all cause a food to be not nearly so healthy and much more pro-inflammatory in the body.
So flaxseed oil is not good?
Well, flaxseed oil is good. The problem is that most researchers feel that the amount of flax that is actually converted to the eicosapentaenoic acid, which is what your fish is at, because it has to go that direction. If you can just think about flax being higher up the chain and fish being lower down the same chain, the amount of flax that actually makes it, flax oil that makes it into the eicosahexaenoic acid and the eicosapentaenoic acid is maybe 5 to 15%. A study was done on lactating females where they gave them a tablespoon a day of flax oil, and they measured what they were doing was measuring the increase of eicosahexaenoic acid that was found in the breast milk after a certain number of weeks of doing that. And what they found, they measured zero increase in the eicosahexaenoic acid.
The DHA.
So, at least in lactating females, it's nothing is going through to the infant.
Is it good to just take DHA or EPA capsules?
Yeah, you know, I have most of my patients take 3,000 milligrams a day as a general average. That's 3,000 milligrams of adding up EPA and DHA. A lot of times your pills will say 1,000 milligrams of omega-3 on the label. But when you add DHA and EPA, it may only add to 500. So that would mean they need to be 6 capsules a day if they're going to do it correctly for the 3,000 amount. And the reason I say 3,000 is only because it's a general average. If you did more specific studies, you could come up with different ratios perhaps, but the United States itself is probably the country that has the greatest amount of the difference between the intake of omega-6 and the amount of omega-3. More countries have greater omega-3 intakes and in some cases, of course, less omega-6 intake from the grain oils. So as a result, we need more omega-3s and less omega-6s. And so the amount of need is considered to be upwards of 3,000 milligrams a day.
We only have a minute left. I can't believe it. We're going to have you back. But could you talk about aspartame?
Yeah, you know, two nights ago, there was a great, I think it was on one of the channels on Discovery or one of those on TV, a whole program on it. I hope they show it again. But again, these things are so terrifically destructive in the body. You're taking in two artificial substances that essentially cause some serious damage potentially damage in the brain. I had a patient who told me her mother had temporary blindness from using it.
We're talking about the artificial sweetener in your kids' pop and in most snack foods. something I'm seeing as a complete destroyer of joints, and we're going to do an article, a bioacoustically speaking article on aspartame, and show you how you're tricked by the numbers. Dr. Truby, thank you for being with us. I have lots more questions. We hope we can have you on as a regular to talk about different health issues and allow people to take some responsibility for their own health care.
It's been my privilege, and I just want to acknowledge Sherry as being one of the true, really wonderful healers that we have in our country. So thank you. It's been a privilege of being here.
Oh, thank you. And thank you, listeners, for taking time out of your busy day to be with us. And